Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I am David Kern and I am joined by my old friends, Heidi White and Tim McIntosh. Heidi, Tim, how's it going? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, David. Good to be here.
We are here to talk about The Odyssey. Books 11 and 12. This is our last section of two books. It's just our last section of two books for the next couple of weeks. We'll do a four book section for next week. So, you know, get reading as soon as you're done listening to this episode, I guess. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so online. Social media is a good place. You can join the Close Reads Facebook group. If you have not done that, just search Close Reads Podcast Discussion Group in Facebook search bar and it should pop up. Click request to join and we will approve you post haste. You can, of course, also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Close Reads Pods. You can sign up for the Close Reads newsletter at closereads.substack.com or you can email us at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. Like I said, we are here to discuss The Odyssey, but we also, a little inside baseball here, we also are going to be recording a bonus episode today after this for those of you who are Patreon supporters. We're going to be doing our monthly short story recording immediately after this, so make sure you're signed up for that. We're going to be talking about a story by Willa Cather. We've also posted stories by Hemingway and Agatha Christie in the last couple months, so if you are a Close Reads Patreon supporter, you can go listen to those now, and if you're not, then you know, consider doing so. It supports the show, helps us do more episodes, helps us pay Tim and Heidi and our editor, Logan. Shout out to Logan, by the way. Check that out. You can go over to patreon.com/closereads to learn more about that. But let's get down to business. Now that we're done with the business, let's get down to business. Books 11 and 12 of The Odyssey. We descend into hell.
Exactly.
And then we wind up out on the open sea. There's a lot we could talk about here, but I wanted to ask you a question about virtue, because last week we talked about the question of Odysseus's virtue. We weren't questioning whether he is virtuous per se, but we were talking about, you know, what were some of the things that the ancient Greeks understood to be virtues, and how might those be different than, you know, what, say, the contemporary Christian virtues might be, or even the sort of Judeo-Christian tradition might suggest they are. And I was wondering if in these books here, we learn anything more about that. Because there were a couple points when I circled something and I wrote, you know, in the margins, virtue question mark, ancient virtue question mark, something like that. So Tim, I was wondering if you could touch on this first, and we'll dive into some of the specifics of these two books. But I thought, you know, this has become something of a through line through these first several episodes of The Odyssey. So why not continue on with that as an entryway into this episode? So what do you think about that, Tim?
One of our all-star listeners, Esther Bills, raised it on the Facebook group. She had a really great question. So like the Close Reads Facebook page is always rife with conversation. Esther posted a question about this very subject. Can I start? Can we, like, I'm going to give an answer to a slightly different question, Dave.
I would expect nothing less of you.
Yeah, right. Like, I'm a politician. I don't answer the question that's been asked me.
Hey, we know how you came up in your adult careers.
Careers. Thank you for making that plural.
The thing that I noticed the most about book 11 especially was less about the virtue, the virtue differences, and more about the kind of cosmological differences. Because here we have our main hero, Odysseus, descend into hell, and he sees, in essence, what is kind of like the hall of fame of ancient Greece. He meets everybody. He doesn't just meet, you know, his mother, but he meets Agamemnon, and he meets Achilles. He relates the story of, you know, Achilles' son to him.
And even Ajax, who they don't like each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think about, okay, so to kind of frame this question, this descent into hell might sound, for those who are unfamiliar with the classical tradition, like, what a peculiar storytelling decision, Homer. Why did you put Odysseus down in hell? But this is a trope that existed before the Odyssey and will be embellished upon after the Odyssey. So before the Odyssey, there's a classic Babylonian myth/story called the Epic of Gilgamesh. Mm-hmm. And one of the oldest books that we have a copy of, clay tablets that were discovered actually relatively recent, like I think within the last 150 years. And it tells the story of Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh is haunted by this worry about what's going to happen to him when he dies. Is there anything like salvation for mortals? And he ends up descending into hell in pursuit of that question. So now the Odyssey, the pursuit is, it's a little bit different. So it's not that Homer and Odysseus are not probing the question of, is there an afterlife directly, or excuse me, is there kind of immortality directly? They're not asking that question. It's more a question of, I hate to say it again, it's more of a tactical question of, how do I get home? Hmm. What do I do when I get there? That's the main question that it seems to me, correct me if you guys see it differently, that Odysseus is pursuing. Now, after the Odyssey, the trope of the main hero descending into hell will be embellished in the Aeneid by Virgil. And then about 1,000 years later, most famously by Dante in the Divine Comedy, which begins with a descent into hell. So I think it's really fascinating that this is kind of like, this is probably the centerpiece story of that trope of the main hero descending into hell. And I think what's really interesting is Dante, coming from the Christian tradition, is the story of the descent to hell is the story of the main character in search of virtue and in search of immortality. And I think by contrast, Odysseus is not on that same search. I don't think he's looking for virtue. I don't think he's looking for immortality. I think he's looking for a way to get home, to rightly order that home, and to pronounce justice on the people who have invaded his home. And that, I think, might be the Greek answer to the quest for virtue. Hmm. So actually, I did answer the question in a very roundabout fashion.
Well done.
Yeah. Well,
so it's interesting that you say that, because early in 11, and Heidi, I'll let you jump in a second here. I just want to reflect on something he's saying there. Around line 105, the prophet, what's the prophet's name in the underworld again?
Tiresias.
Yeah. He says, I think Poseidon will not cease to feel incensed because you blinded his dear son. And then this line, you have to suffer, but you can get home if you control your urges and your men. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I was thinking about is how you're right. There is the sense that for him, it's, you know, it is tactical. The mission to the underworld is sort of tactical, and everyone's constantly giving him advice on how to go about accomplishing his ultimate mission, his ultimate goal, giving him even tactical advice, right? But all that tactical advice seems to be wrapped up in questions that are questions related to virtue, though. Even if his goals are not about virtue, the advice people are giving him are virtue adjacent anyway, such as if you control your urges,
right,
and your men, you know, if you have a certain degree of virtue in you, then your ultimate goal will be found. And so everywhere he looks, people are telling him, you can't follow your urges. You can't give in to temptation. You have to be strong enough to avoid the things that are, you know, sort of your innermost, what seem like in the moment anyway, your innermost desires. You have to be able to rule yourself. in order to ultimately fulfill the mission that you have before you. And so the two seem pretty intertwined, don't they? Even to the ancient, even in this ancient tale, even if not in Odysseus's mind, to the storyteller and the other characters, it seems like at least the people who are giving him advice, the two things are intertwined: virtue and then the sort of ultimate mission.
And self-control is one of the fruits of the spirit. There's an obvious and clear compatibility between that aspect of the Greek vision of virtues and the Christian vision of the virtues. I think it's really interesting that I would suspect that many of the virtues, if we just kind of like could make a list of the Greek, of the Homeric Greek vision of the virtues and the Christian vision of the virtues, I bet there would be a large number of, there would be indeed overlap, self-control being one of them. I think what's interesting is the virtues are always hierarchical. They're not just
in the Greek, in the ancient world.
I think, yeah, in the ancient world and in the Christian vision of things. I don't think that, how do I say this? Rahab, for example, lies. She's dishonest when the people of Jericho are attempting to find out the spies from Israel. And later, the Christian Bible praises her for that, for what she does. So she breaks a virtue, the virtue of honesty, in order to exercise a higher virtue, let's say honoring God, or maybe you could even say the preservation of life. So I think there's every culture that has kind of like a robust sense of, let's use our term, of the virtues or of good moral action behavior, those clusters don't just hang equally upon the tree, but there's a star at the top of that tree typically, and it's kind of like a master virtue. Or for the Christians, you would say like there are three master virtues, and it'd be faith, hope, and love. And the other virtues kind of like fall underneath those three master virtues.
In which Close Reads turns into a podcast on virtue ethics. That's what this is. Heidi, what do you have to say about all this?
I've
been waiting patiently.
I'm so interested. I love this. I think to go along with what both of you have said, that this center portion, this is the chronological, or not the chronological center, but the, it's not the chrono, the chronology is all strange in this book, but this
in
is
terms the, of the number center, of books.
Like the, in terms of, no, not, yes, I guess so. The length, in terms of the length of the Odyssey, these two books are right in the middle, and that's always important. And that's when Aeneas goes into the underworld, also in the Aeneid. And so I'm in this unique position right now in which I'm reading the Odyssey for Close Reads. I'm teaching the Iliad to high schoolers for the school year, and then I'm also reading the Aeneid for the apprenticeship. So I'm reading all three of the big epics at the same time. So I have a lot of opportunity to compare.
To get confused.
To tie threads together. So I'm thinking as you guys are talking that for Odysseus, I think he does display great virtue. I agree with Tim that there's a tactical choice here that he's making. He's not on a journey of the soul like Dante is, to your point, Tim. But his virtue is that even though Odysseus, as we've been talking about over these weeks, is more than a man in many ways, he does continually, even in this portion, reject the immortality that is offered to him by the deathless gods for the sake of going home. He's continually saying, no, I know that I may have kind of these manly Greek heroic virtues more than a man. He accepts that. He owns that. He's not like, oh no, I'm just a guy. Like, he knows that he is in many ways more than the regular man, but he keeps rejecting the destiny of the demigod in order to go home for Penelope, for Ithaca, for Telemachus, for this like unified life of an earthly man. And And if you look at the other epics, say Gilgamesh fails, he just flat out fails to win immortality. Achilles actually rejects home. He rejects being a regular guy. He knows he has to choose. He has two fates. He's the only one in mythology who ever gets to choose between two fates. And he rejects being an ordinary man. And he chooses glory. And Aeneas actually loses his home. And he must, throughout the entire Aeneid, sublimate any personal desires in order to do his duty. He doesn't want, we never know what Aeneas wants. He just has to do what the gods tell him to do. But Odysseus, however, I think, in these two center books and for the rest of the epic, he comes the closest to fulfilling the Christian ideal of any kind of pre-Christian mythology or epic that's written in the future, because he unifies his glory and his home, and he rejects any attempt to overreach himself because of his great love for his family. So I think that's what we see here in these center books.
Heidi. Yes. I had a conversation with our mutual friend, Rudy Reidelhuber, when I was driving home from Santa Fe. And he, oh my,
shout out to Rudy.
Yeah. And it's going to be a double shout out, because he has this kind of vision of the Odyssey as kind of, I don't want to misrepresent Rudy, because it's such a sophisticated, thoughtful view. I was like, man, maybe David could let us bring Rudy on to do a Patreon episode. But it's exactly what you said, Heidi. There's this kind of sense that the bridegroom, who for Christians is Christ, and for the Greeks is Odysseus, the bridegroom is estranged from his home. And then there will be a return, and that return will bring both a unity with the beloved and justice for his enemies. Anyway, Rudy was just like really superb on this. So all that to say, yeah, absolutely, Heidi. This is, we're going to start to see, especially when Odysseus returns home after book 12, when he kind of like turns his ships toward home. We're going to start to see this sort of the allegorical aspects of the Odyssey really start to kind of, for me, match up with this sense of God returning to be with his beloved. And I think the similarities in those two stories is remarkable. I feel like I have been playing up the dissimilarities between the Homeric Greek vision of the virtues and the Christian vision of the virtues, because I am keen to maybe to help readers not paste a Christian virtue onto Homer, because it is so tempting to do that. It's so tempting to do that with every sort of like ancient piece of literature. And I am just keen to kind of like highlight the differences, and maybe I'm highlighting the differences a little bit too much. You guys should tell me.
No, I think what we're trying to say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'll just say what I'm trying to say, is that it's, we cannot come in and use our faith as some kind of, literary criticism. But what I love about the Odyssey is that it prefigures exactly what you're saying. In every way, it is an allegory of the gospel, the faithful wife waiting at home for to be rescued by the king who is going to return and slay the suitors, the dangers that are besetting them, and restore the kingdom. And it's a remarkable thing that was written before our faith, before Jesus came. And that speaks, I think, to these echoes of eternity that have gone throughout human history. And that, I think, is the proper way to see, or a proper way to see Odysseus as this great and mighty king who is a precursor to Christ. When Christ comes, he fulfills then in truth
these threads that are thrown out in pagan literature before him. And they don't even mean to be prophetic. They're not trying to. They just do. They just are, because those things, eternity is written in our hearts, as scripture tells us. And so whenever we write a great story, it's going to echo the story of the world, which is creation groaning to be saved.
You can probably hear, I'm speaking to David and maybe our listeners, you can probably hear in what Heidi is saying and what I'm saying, there's a couple of different ways that you can think about how one's Christian faith ought to influence one's reading of a book. And I am with Heidi. I think it's part of the reason we find ourselves agreeing so often on the show is because I think I belong to the same school as you, Heidi. And I'm going to say we kind of come from the C.S. Lewis school. So
yes,
you guys know Experiment in Criticism. Basically, I'm gonna give a very short, hopefully accurate articulation of what Lewis argues in that book. Basically,
he argues a lot in that book.
there is. But I think he tries to highlight two main kind of ways of reading a book. Okay, one of them I think is the way that Heidi and I think David and I would all recommend, which is you let the book speak for itself. It kind of creates its own world, and it creates within that world rules for the characters and a reality that they have to live by. Now, those worlds are very often closely tied. They can never be too far distant from the rules of our actual world, or they just don't make sense to the reader. So they have to kind of be patterned in some way after the rules of the actual world. Like there's things like gravity. There's another way of reading, which would say, yes, those rules of our world are so powerful and so patterned that you can actually sort of form an uber criticism or a meta criticism. And I think the biggest proponents of that, I'll mention two of them. One of them is, help me for a second, you guys, The Hero with 1,000 Faces. What's wrong with it? No, I want to look at, hold on. I'm going to look it up. Hopefully
Joseph Campbell. I don't know. In my head, I was saying Campbell, but I said Conrad.
Yes. Joseph Campbell. Guys.
Joseph Campbell. Yeah.
So for Joseph Campbell, there's sort of there's an uber myth, and all of the particular myths sort of conform in one way or another to that kind of uber myth,
the archetypal hero, and so forth.
The archetypal hero, exactly. So I'm gonna put someone who I really respect. I'm gonna put Jordan Peterson in that group. So Jordan Peterson has kind of become really popular in a lot of ways, and I think that he would probably. I think he's very, very sophisticated in the way that he reads, but I think that he does think that there's something like kind of archetypal heroes and archetypal journeys. And then in some ways I do too. But I think when reading a piece of literature, if you take those kind of preformed patterns and you impress and you take the pattern and you sort of force it onto the cookie dough of the story, then what do you know? You're going to get the same pattern over and over. And I think what I like about C.S. Lewis is it really does dignify the storyteller and the story and the characters and the culture that we're reading about in literature. And it gives them their own voice. It gives them their own voice. And that's where I think Lewis is trying to articulate an Experiment in Criticism, that there are these two broad camps. Both of them have great merit. I do belong, and I think that we belong, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys, in the kind of former category, which is the books create their own patterns. They create their own dynamics. They create their own rules. And we are here.
Yeah, they have their own language.
Yeah, and we are here to understand them, not to tell them what they actually meant.
Yep. Agreed. Well, and the problem with with the archetypal criticism is that it tends to not know where the myth even came from, right? Like Joseph Campbell just says in A Hero with a Thousand Faces that all stories kind of are trying to tell this one story, but that one story is created by the story. It's circular reasoning. And so what Christians say is we know the story they're trying to tell. There is a fundamental story. There is a overarching story that all stories are going to try to reach towards, that Echoes of Eternity idea. And it succeeds or fails insofar as it attempts in truth to get there. And the Odyssey absolutely attempts to get there.
Hmm. Well, we could just do a deep dive on literary theory if we want.
Or we could talk about the Odyssey.
There's a couple. So we've got, what we have left is we've got Clytemnestra, right? The maybe the most real villain of the whole story. We've got, he meets Agamemnon and he comes back up. Then he goes, they go back up to Circe and she tells him about the sirens and Scylla and Charybdis and his men all get destroyed in one fell swoop. And I think that there is this, it's interesting that the concept of analogy has come up, because I think that these books, maybe it's because they're so crucial, that because they're in the middle of the story and thus have been told and retold, much like the Cyclops story over and over again, they tend to start to take on the sort of, maybe it's by reputation, the sort of tone of analogy, you know, like if you, the sirens, for example, right? And somebody posted a picture of Big Dan on the Facebook group, you know, the John Goodman character from A Brother, Where Art Thou? Yeah. And A Brother, Where Art Thou is basically just a retelling of the Odyssey. And they've been, you know, they've made no bones about that. They haven't pretended that it's not. And so sometimes you look at something like Scylla and Charybdis or the sirens, and what stands out the most is the Pilgrim's Progressness of it all. Like, you know, if you don't pay attention to what you hear and what you see, then you're going to be destroyed by the sirens.
Right.
In your experience then, do you find that students tend to gravitate towards that sort of a reading and then sort of shut down? How do you, you've taught this book, you're teaching it now. Well, no, you're teaching the Iliad now, aren't you? Mm-hmm. But when you've taught this, do you find that sort of reading naturally, instinctively sort of happens, that modern students have sort of been conditioned to that, and it sort of makes them think, you know, sort of makes it less meaningful in a sense, because right. It sort of becomes about following a rule or a lesson or something like that you get out of it?
Yes, they see in it just a simplistic fable about obedience. And to be honest,
temptation or whatever.
Yes, and to be honest, in this part of the story, there's a certain validity to that. There's, I mean, Tiresias and Circe have given Odysseus a set of instructions. You know, like, this is going to happen to you, and this is how you are to respond to it. And
yeah, and don't be a dummy. That's basically
exactly. And in some ways, he follows it to the letter of the law, and in some ways, kind of strangely, he completely ignores the warnings. And so,
like, for example, putting on his best armor,
right?
When they're passing Scylla and Charybdis,
exactly it, or even listening to the sirens, and certainly landing on the island where the cattle are. And so, and there is a kind of a sense in which any thoughtful reader is going to encounter particularly the cattle part of the story and wonder exactly what we talked about last week. Is Odysseus spinning this tale in telling it to Arete and Alcinous in the banqueting hall? And there's some evidence, even in the text, that he's not telling the whole truth about that. So, this...
One of my favorite bits is when all of a sudden he's like, no, I know this because Clytemnestra told me. I mean, yep. No, Calypso told me and Hermes told her. He like has that little aside. As, yes. And I imagine everybody who's watching him looking at him like, how do you know this?
How do you know that?
Trust me. I was told.
Yep. I told that. The gods told me. Which in some ways, I look at that as like a writer. And I think Homer's a genius because he's thinking to himself, how would Odysseus know this? I have to explain to his audience in some way how Odysseus knows something that he couldn't possibly know. So, or he's just making it. So it, yeah. So there's a lot of question marks here. And so that question of, can this part of the Odyssey be reduced to a fable? It can, but it probably shouldn't. You know, there is a do this and don't do that. And Odysseus sometimes obeys and sometimes doesn't. But I think if you're going to miss a lot, particularly about the character of our hero, if you just look at it as this kind of series of fables and obedience to the gods.
Tim, do your students, like you taught college most recently, did you find that college students tend to look at the story, for example, of the sirens that way? Or do they just not read it? Say no, they do.
I didn't find them doing that. I mean, most of them were familiar with the phrase, you know, or sort of like the
concept of a siren.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't find, Gutenberg was so good at, still is so good at preparing students to read well, that I think that they would not read the Odyssey until their junior or senior year. And at that point they were so well equipped to read that they typically did not do that. My younger students, I don't remember that happening, but I would think that when I taught high school, they would be more inclined to do that. But then again, I don't remember anybody kind of like playing up the sirens as this moral fable in waiting.
Why do you think that the sirens chapter, we get the sirens, Scylla and Charybdis, and the, what's the island? The cow island?
Helios.
Yeah. We get all that jammed into one book, which I find interesting. And right in the middle of the book, as Heidi mentioned earlier, it's book 12 in an epic poem that has 24 books. And in other earlier books, even in Odysseus' little story here, he's stretched out these tales a little bit. So why do you guys think those three stories, those three trials or whatever, get jammed into this middle book? What does that mean for the structure of the book, but also, you know, thematically? And is it just that Odysseus was getting tired of telling a story, so he just kind of was like, time to wrap it up. I got to get on the road. Tim, what do you think about that?
I think it has the effect upon us of almost creating exhaustion. Like it's hard.
Because it's so bang, 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 back to back.
Oh man, it's so action packed. It's so, just the scene of trying to sail between Scylla and Charybdis, and then they make it, they are starving to death. They violate the sun god's, whatever, Tiresias' order about not eat the cattle. They're blown back out to sea. The ship is destroyed. Some of the men, again, are eaten by Scylla and Charybdis. It's just one thing after the other. And I think it's really hard to convey to a reader what exhaustion feels like. Like it's, you can convey to a reader what a battle scene feels like, you know, like a really capable writer, and Homer in the Iliad is, there's none more capable, can make you feel like you're there. But exhaustion is different because exhaustion is sort of a depletion of resources, not an activity. But I wonder if all of this action is packed so densely in to really convey how tired, how exhausted and depleted our hero is.
Yeah, I think that comes through for sure in these books. And we also have to feel the weight of Odysseus's great sufferings before, this is another way of saying what you just said, Tim, that this is like the bottleneck of the story. This is the there's so much pressure on Odysseus in the story that he's telling, because we're always remembering he's telling a story in order to get the sympathy and help for this last leg of his journey. He's one leg away from home, and everything depends on enlisting the sympathy of Alcinous and Arete right now. And so he, and you can feel how careful, this to your point you made earlier too, David, like you can feel how carefully he's telling this story. And then the story itself is full of these impossible trials and this incredible suffering. And Odysseus is always focusing on that, how much he has lost. And it doesn't feel, you know, people read this and people read this section of the Odyssey books 9 through 12. This is what people read in, say, college, their, you know, overview of world literature class. They read the Odyssey books 9 through 12, and they think of it as this great adventure story. But that's not how Odysseus is telling it. Odysseus is telling it as a record of his manifestly horrendous sufferings, and all he wants is their help to get home.
Heidi, that's such a great point. I you reminded me, like, that this is not a story told in a vacuum around the fire to strangers. This is a story told with intent, that Odysseus is trying to solicit the help of people who can actually get him back on the road, on the sea.
He's trying to draw empathy.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, and you, I mean, just how tactically, I mean, Tim keeps using that word, and actually Homer uses that word. Odysseus, the great tactician. Even something as simple as he's telling the story of his visit to the underworld in book 11, and he begins with Tiresias, and then, because that's what part of the story has to be told, and then he goes straight to his mother and a list of great noble women. And who is he telling the story to? He has been told by Nausicaa to get the sympathy of her mother. That's his first goal. You get my mom on your side and everything will be fine. So he tells this story by, here's Tiresias, I got to get the prophecy in there. And then I'm going to tell of all these great and noble women, beloved by the gods, who gave birth to heroes and who were strong and mighty. And that's what he leads with in the presence of this strong, mighty, great, noble lady whose sympathy he's trying to enlist.
Hmm. There's this
great point.
I was thinking a lot while reading this time. This is related to what you're saying, but it might take me a minute to get back around there, or we can move on, I guess. I was noticing reading book 12 in particular, but I think he does it through the whole of his little retelling of his journeys here to the Phaeacians. Mm-hmm. There's this sort of bittersweet sense of like nostalgia and longing and things like that in the story. You, for example, in book 12, there's that bit where he says that sweet sleep melted from my eyes. I rushed back to the ship beside the shore. And when I was close, the meaty smell of cooking enfolded me. I groaned, and then he talks to the gods. And I was thinking about how there's this sort of constant dichotomy being brought up, or this contrast between what, for lack of a better word, I would call the, you know, pleasures, sweet sleep, which is a phrase that's used, he uses over and over and over again, or at least in her translation, Emily Wilson does. And I actually like that she repeats that. And then there's that sort of concept of the meaty smell of cooking and these, mm-hmm. you know, these longings, the concept of pleasure versus that book 11 idea of controlling urges. And he, as he's telling the story, seems to be, I'm not going to say I wouldn't say he's necessarily doing it on purpose, although maybe he is, but it seems that under the surface, the subtext of his story is the tribulation that is rejecting pleasure and controlling urges, and the relationship between that and getting home, and then getting home, fulfilling that ultimate mission or whatever, as Tim put it earlier, that only happens through rejecting pleasure and controlling urges. And even if that's not something that he is, I've been debating with myself whether he's doing that on purpose, I guess. And that's part of his seeking of empathy, because he brings it up a lot. This seems like a pretty consistent contrast over the last several books. So is he sort of dropping that in there to make himself appear more godlike, you know, to draw empathy from the Phaeacians and then thus get their help? Or is it truly subtext? That's just part of, you know, there is that this, it's just sort of something that's you know, he's thinking back about all the things that he didn't do, or even when he's, you know, he falls asleep and there is this sort of like sense that that sleep is, he never gets quite enough of it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, as he's journeying. I mean, it makes things seem more difficult and makes it more of a trial. Does it make sense what I'm saying?
Yes, it does. And I think it's a really interesting point, because both times, now he's been telling this story since book 9, and both times that he falls asleep in the story during the day,
yeah, like
takes a nap, his men betray his direct instructions and bring doom upon them. And so in some sense, you have Odysseus's humanity, his need for sleep, is betraying his heroic nature, right? Because mm-hmm. he slept, then he wasn't watchful, and then his men kind of ran amok, and he's the one who keeps them in line.
So in a sense, that in and of itself could be, you know, sort of the Phaeacians could look kindly at him, because, you know, he's like, I'm just a man. I can't, right. You know, I need some help.
Right. And so there's, so then it's kind of like that sense of his humanity betrays him. And, but, oh, it's so endearing. The guy just needed some sleep. You know, what's a guy to do who's been watching over his men who are about to ruin everything in every second?
Which, of course, is what his men say to him. You haven't let us right. sleep.
Exactly. And then, but then on the other side, you're right about the food. Food's such a big deal in the epics. How people eat food, what kind of food they eat, how they cook it, how they prepare it.
Yeah, they ate
it,
those cows for a week.
And that scene is so eerie, right? Like the cows come alive moving, even when they're yeah. being cooked, and they're mooing, and they're like clawing and creeping and climbing at him. Because it's magic food, and that's bad because humans just need human food. And that's a huge theme of the Odyssey, that you know, I keep thinking of, say, in the liturgy, when we say the holy things are for the holy, there's this great sense in the epics of that there's things that are for the gods, and that there's things that are for men. And when men try to have the things of the gods, they must then be put back in their place. And that's why I find Odysseus's choice to listen to the sirens so fascinating. I keep coming back to that whenever I read this. Why did he choose that? Because in every other case, he chooses the earthly things, his home, his family, food that's cooked properly. You know, that he doesn't overreach himself, except in that case. And that is so fascinating to me. I can't explain that.
Is it, Heidi, is it kind of like, Odysseus is this sort of border figure between
yes.
divine and human. And yes, he chooses the human because he knows that it's right, but he still has this sort of like almost like a demigod ability to hear this incredible divine music. And he's the only one, and he has to bind himself to wood. He has to like bind himself to his like earthly nature in order to be able to hear it, but still he gets to hear it in the way that his men can't. Or if they did, they'd all be dead.
Right. It's true. And he gets to go down to the underworld and come back alive. He's the only one twice dead. And Circe says that to him. He's the one that is chosen by two goddesses to unite with the divine nature in this physical and metaphorical sense. And yet he continually says, I just want to go home. And that's why I don't like the Tennyson poem, the Ulysses poem. Everybody loves that poem. I don't like it because it is, I don't think it's consistent with Odysseus's true nature, which is, I just want to go home.
I don't know the Tennyson poem well enough to like it or dislike it, Heidi. What are you thinking about that poem that you dislike?
Because he leaves Penelope, calls her this an aged wife. He leaves her because he just wants to go out and go on adventures. He leaves Telemachus. He talks about how boring it is in life in Ithaca, and I have to go out and, you know, drink life to the lees, and I have become a name, and I'm going to gather my men together, and we're going to go out again. And I don't think that's Odysseus. I don't think that's what we see in the Odyssey,
especially the second half of the Odyssey.
And I think is what David just mentioned about kind of these earthly things, these earthy concrete things of the world that keep being mentioned over and over again in this grand epic, by Odysseus himself as being the things that tie him to home. And he's always describing rocky Ithaca, and he wants to get home, and he keeps talking about the food he wants to eat at home, right? I want to go home, and I want to eat this food in my own dining hall with my wife and my son, and I want to hear the music of my bard. And there's just this, he has never forgotten the goodness of just being an ordinary man. But he's constantly being tempted by these false homecomings to go beyond his ordinary humanity and live in that borderland that you're talking about. And I see him as just saying, no, that's not what I want, except with the sirens.
Hmm. Wait, what do you mean? Except like with the sirens.
Because he chooses to listen to their music, even knowing that it will ruin him. And he even talks about that later. He never liked music again after he heard the song of the sirens. But that's kind of the moment that he seems to reject, not reject being an ordinary man, but he seems to kind of say, okay, I know I can handle it. My men can't handle it, but I can.
Well, but he's told to do that, isn't he? I mean,
he's told, given the option of doing that. He tells his men that Circe told him to. And here's what I mean. In book 12, there's some indications of his deception. He tells his men, Circe told me to listen to the voice of the sirens. Mm-hmm. But Circe told him, don't do it. But if you want to, have your men lash you to the mast.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
She so gives him the option.
Heidi, why does the story of the sirens, Odysseus' kind of response to the sirens, different for you than sleeping with Calypso and with Circe? Because you could make the case that that's him kind of like stepping into this sort of demigod role. Is the difference that sleeping with Calypso and Circe was under compulsion?
Right. It's a good question. And this is what I've been thinking. David's been thinking about this thing he just mentioned. This is the thing I've been thinking about. So the Circe interlude happens before Calypso, and he willingly stays with Circe for 1 year. And
chronologically, not when the books happen. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. In the chronological unfolding of this story, Circe comes first, Calypso comes later. And so I'm wondering if this is in some ways the growth of Odysseus, because he does stay with Circe for a year, and it is his men who remind him it's time to go. And when he goes to Circe and says it's time to go, she's like, sure, go ahead. So at any point, and the implication is she would have let him go any time, and he stayed with her. So, but then with Calypso, it's very clear from the text that he never wants to be there. So, and she keeps him as a pet, right? And so what I'm wondering is if this is kind of the growth of Odysseus, and him listening to the sirens is, you know, there's no judgment on it in the text, but it seems to me to be inconsistent with him and his constant choice to be an ordinary person over and over again. So I know I'm not expressing this very well, but I'm noticing it. And I'm definitely not I approach these books every time I read them, I get something new about them. I have more questions than answers. And so this is one of my questions in reading it this time, is why does he listen to the sirens when in every other case he seems to choose kind of those earthly things, those ordinary man things?
Hey, while we're on this subject, Heidi and David, I hope that when we get like near the end of this book, I might make the case that Odysseus does not grow as a character. He's certainly not static, and I don't mean, if I do argue, and I'm reluctant to argue because I don't know how many times I've been through the Odyssey, but I'm like you, Heidi, every time I go through, you know, especially when you're reading a book that's however, like 2,700 years old, It's difficult and it's complicated. But in previous readings, I've thought, does he actually change, or is the reason the book is so fulfilling is because he acts like himself the whole time? And he doesn't like really learn that much. He just either gets to act like himself and triumph over his enemies, or he doesn't. So maybe when we get to the end of the later in the book, we can raise that question.
It's a good question. I think a very big, very good question. And it's when he gets back home, which we're going to get there. I can't wait for that. Lots of people think the second half of the Odyssey drags, but I love every minute of it.
I agree.
Because this is the man, this is the mission he's been on the whole time. This is where he's headed. And now he's been born again, brought out of the realm of the dead. He goes through these great sufferings so that the prophecy is fulfilled, the prophecy from Polyphemus and from Tiresias and from Circe. All three of them tell him the same thing. You're going to get home and you're going to have lost all of your men and you're going to find your home beset with dangers. And that's, your homecoming is not going to be what you want it to be. And still, he's like, that's what I want to do anyway. I'm not staying with you goddesses. That's where I'm going there. I'm going home.
What? So why do you think that the sirens then, I mean, we get, I don't know, less than 10 lines of the sirens. There's no description of them. He just talks about their melodious singing. Why do you think they are, I mean, them and the Cyclops are like the two things that are kind of like part of, you know, mm-hmm. Everybody knows that in the Odyssey, there's the Cyclops and the sirens, right? Of all the sort of characters, even if you've never really read it, you know about that probably if you're familiar at all. Why did the sirens become such a staple of culture at large? Given we get 10 lines, there's no description. Literally no one dies from the sirens. The one thing they run into that no one dies.
David, I think it's for the reason that you alluded to earlier. It's that story is so easily allegorized into kind of like a virtue quest, you know? Where for me, the Scylla and Charybdis story, which is also pretty famous, but probably not as well known as the sirens, it's a little bit harder to allegorize. Maybe it's a way you can allegorize Scylla and Charybdis as a way of saying, choose the middle path. Wisdom is choosing the middle path between two great harms or something like that. But the sirens are something that you can so easily applied to kind of everyday life, that like, oh, there's this thing that I want that I know is so bad for me, and I just want to be able to hear it without actually being tempted by it. That's my hunch about why the sirens are so commonly known. Do you have another idea, Heidi?
No, I think that that's exactly it. And I also think it just has this, it is just such a metaphor for the human pilgrimage, mm-hmm. right? This and Odysseus is constantly tempted by false homecomings. That is the theme of the Odyssey, that there's false homecomings. Don't pick that. Don't choose that. Odysseus is a hero because he made it home, and then he fought even worse battles once he got there. Mm. And the sirens are the embodiment of that. They're like the perfect metaphor. The beautiful women luring a man to his doom, that is the metaphor of temptation from time immemorial.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking though that I was noticing, I guess, that unless Circe mentions it or whatever, he never says that they're beautiful women.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, did he not?
Is that true?
That's what I was thinking. That's the one of the, I mean, he says their song was melodious. I long to listen for more. He doesn't say that he sees them, their honeyed song poured from their mouths. Music brings them joy. And I don't know, maybe Circe said they're beautiful women.
That's interesting.
The sirens who sit in their meadow will seduce him with pierces. She would. Nope. That's really interesting. Now, Jason.
I didn't say she would. I love that.
Now, The sirens are also in, are they in Jason of the Argonauts? And they're in the Aeneid.
Yeah, so, and El Brother Martha.
Of course. Well, and they're perfect. Actually, we love that movie at our house.
Oh, that's, yeah, it's a great movie.
A lot of how my kids know the Odyssey is children's versions. And
hey, have you guys seen that Robert Redford movie, The Natural, about, he plays this.
Yeah.
So have you ever thought about The Natural as the story of the Odyssey?
Not really.
It's a little, it's not as direct as O Brother, Where Art Thou? But I think it's the story of the Odyssey. There's this wonderful scene in which the owner of the team is trying to guess how, and he, I think, is the Cyclops character, is trying to guess how much change Robert Redford has in his pockets. And he looks at Robert Redford and he covers one eye and he kind of leans toward the camera and this one eye is bulging out. And he's trying to kind of like foresee how much Robert Redford has in his pockets. And yeah. And there are these women. So there's at the beginning, Glenn Close is Robert Redford's girlfriend and she stays at home and he goes out and launches his baseball career and he's attacked by a woman who's terrible for him. Is this Calypso? Maybe. He's kind of seduced by this other woman, famous 1980s blonde actress. I can't remember her name right now. Is she maybe Circe? And then he finally returns home to Glenn Close. It's a really good movie also. My family like adored watching that movie. My sister and I still kind of quote lines back and forth to each other. And I think it's telling of the Odyssey.
Much better than the book, by the way. One of the rare occasions, in my opinion.
Oh, really? I didn't even know it was a book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Very pretty famous book.
Hey, I know we're probably like getting ready to go fairly soon. I have a question. My question is, what is the big deal with the Cattle of Helios? So the opening lines of the whole book mention the sun god's cattle. Mm-hmm. And I think, so let me just read those lines. This is beginning in book seven of the opening book, book one. He, Odysseus, failed to keep them safe, poor fools. They ate the sun god's cattle and the god kept them from home, et cetera, et cetera. And I just think, man, of all the different things that go wrong in the Odyssey, why does this one get banner headlines in the opening paragraph of the opening book? Do you guys have a notion of that? Am I missing something?
That is the failure that he participates in. That's not something that happened to him. He's the subject, not the object here.
Meaning he acquiesced to the killing of the cattle?
Meaning that he that the other sufferings that Odysseus went through, if you take his word for it within the story, actually were something that happened to him. Right? Calypso takes him
how would you say this is different?
And in this case, he chose to land on...
Oh, he let them go ahead and land on the island, and then he went to sleep.
Yes. So he did it. And he was warned before
inability to control his men.
Yes. So, for example, with Polyphemus, he's an active participant in that, but he wasn't warned about that. That's something, in many ways, that happened to him. Right, like Polyphemus knew that Odysseus was coming, but Odysseus didn't have any kind of prophecy that he was going to land there. But in this case, with the sun god's cattle, like he had the opportunity to steer by the island, and he didn't. He landed there. He told the men, but he's responsible for what happened there in a way that he isn't with his other sufferings. If again, you take his word for it.
Like Scylla and Charybdis also.
Although that's the thing that Virgil and Dante blame him for, right? But that's not what the story blames him for. If you're talking about the terms of the story itself, it's the eating of the sun god's cattle that fulfills the prophecy of Polyphemus and Tiresias.
I hate to keep harping on this, but I really do think I see the failure here as a failure of ability, not a failure of character, if that makes sense. I mean, when you're reading the story of the men, you know, like wanting to eat the sun god's cattle, Odysseus is off and away and he's just kind of exhausted and he lets down his guard for a moment and the men do what they're going to do, which he's warned them about. It's sort of like his failure is not that he was really lazy. I mean, he's totally, completely exhausted beyond like human capacity.
And I'm hungry.
hungry. He's starving. That's right. That's the other thing that Homer highlights is how hungry he is. And it's funny because Homer will like drive home with great dexterity the point of his hunger and his thirst and his exhaustion. And then when he slips up a little bit, Homer kind of pounces on him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think culturally speaking, today, I think we have plenty of faults. I think one thing we have great empathy. And I think it's hard to sympathize with Homer here for punishing or for the gods, for punishing Odysseus, because we can empathize so much with just the raw exhaustion that he and his men are enduring. And it feels to me like it's a little unjust to let them have it given their state.
You're saying that the gods are unjust?
Can you believe that I would make that argument?
You know, it's funny. Okay, so this relates to something that I guess this will be my final thought, because I was thinking about, I mentioned earlier Clytemnestra. Maybe she's the sort of biggest villain in the whole story. And I was thinking about all the different, I don't want to say villain, all the different obstacles Odysseus and his men, or at least Odysseus, face. You have Calypso and Circe, you have some of the gods themselves, Scylla and Charybdis and the Cyclops and the Sirens, and in some ways his men's lack of fortitude, his own question, you know, his own need to have fortitude. There's all these different things all ultimately leading up to, well, I guess you see it, the ocean itself as kind of stirred up by the gods, and then ultimately leading up to the suitors. And I was thinking about how, are any of those real villains? Like really, like inherently sort of like their purpose in the story, yes, is to like be an obstacle for him, right? But even the Cyclops, is he like evil? Right. Are the Sirens evil? No, their nature is to do something that is dangerous to people, and thus people should avoid them. And so I was thinking about how you've talked a lot about the concept of like false homecomings, and you know, even like Calypso and Circe are not evil, you know.
Right.
And so then the suitors are the next thing that maybe they're evil, but also they're, you know, they might just be being what's the word. Just taking advantage of the situation.
Right.
Maybe they're not, maybe evil is the wrong thing. They're certainly an obstacle. They're certainly maybe like the bad guy. But in Clytemnestra, we get like, that's real villainy. And, mm-hmm. you know, he learns about her story and what she did, you know, to Agamemnon in the underworld. And for Odysseus, that has to be something that's sort of like hovering over his thoughts, right? Like, what does he need to look out for when he's getting home? He's even warned of that. And his, you know, he has this sense of faith in Penelope that she's going to be faithful to him. But I was just thinking about how of all the things they run up against, none of them you could really say are evil, but
right.
Clytemnestra is is that's true Shakespearean villainy there. and that of false homecoming comes in book 11, I think is really important because it's right before, you know, he finds out if he's going to, you know, right before he finds out if he's going to get help and he's going to head home. And we're going to ultimately get the sort of, you know, the story of what happens when he makes it home. And, you know, if that had happened in book 7 or book 8, it still would be meaningful, but I wonder if it'd be less meaningful or less sort of cast less of a pall on his the final stages of his journey. Because for us, it sort of is hovering over the story. Even if we know, because of the Telemachy, that Penelope is faithful to him, the story's not the same without that bit. You could almost substitute any magical creature, any storm, it could have been anything else. In some ways, they could be substituted for the Cyclops or, you know, some other beautiful demigod instead of demigoddess instead of Calypso or whatever. But that's the one story I think that has to be there, that is like essential to the nature of the story, like is uniquely, distinctly necessary to be there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
David, it makes total sense. And I completely agree. But wouldn't that make the suitors, in some ways, they're just as evil as Clytemnestra? And the only difference between them is Clytemnestra was successful and they haven't yet been successful.
Yeah, but I think that, you know...
They're homewreckers. They're all homewreckers.
Yeah, but that's like, okay, so... I mean, we'll talk about degree of virtues. We can talk about, maybe we should talk about the degree of evil as well. Because,
right.
You know, is it worse to go in there and take advantage of a situation when you don't actually think Odysseus is going to come home? Like, there's no way they thought he was coming home, right? So they're taking advantage of the situation. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not villainous in some degree, but is that actually as bad or worse than Clytemnestra knowing he's coming home and then and then treacherously destroying her own home? And her husband. I guess that's the distinction I would make.
I would argue that the suitors claim to think that he's not coming home, but why do they worry so much that he might be? And they, I mean, you know, they're worried about it. So, but I think, like in the Greek view, the argument could be Clytemnestra is worse. Let me make sure I say this the right way. The intention of both Clytemnestra and the suitors is the same. They both have intentions of basically usurping, let's make it like simple, usurping a home or usurping their place within a home. Let's say that. Mm-hmm. And I think the Greeks would say, yeah, actually Clytemnestra was worse because she was successful. The suitors were a little bit less bad just because they weren't successful. Whereas I think...
Or they failed because they weren't bad enough.
Yeah. Maybe you could say that. Maybe you could say that. And I think that would be true. But your bigger point about like these other things, like the Scylla and Charybdis and the Cyclops sort of acting within their nature. And so they're against the hero and they're bad in that way. But in some ways they're not bad like Clytemnestra and the suitors because the Cyclops is acting in accord with its nature. Its nature is like debauched in the Greek view, like almost like completely immoral. It has no community. It has no law. It lives completely for
itself. It's a barbarian.
What's that?
He's a barbarian.
He's a barbarian. But, you know, he's kind of still just like acting in accord with his nature.
Well, and like the sirens, that's the big one. That's when I started thinking about it because it talks about how their singing gave them pleasure or whatever. And they're just these creatures, whatever they are, women, whatever. And they're just, all they do is sing. You don't even get the sense that, I mean, are they anything worse than like a tornado, for example?
Right.
Right.
Like, I don't think so.
Is there evil agency behind them? Like that their mission is to destroy things. Like, right. Or are they a hurricane? Are they a tornado? Are they something that's just, they are sort of the
a force of nature.
A force of nature, a sort of confluence of circumstances such that it leads to the demise of people who do not avoid them and do not, you know, and therefore who do not listen to people who can warn about them. I don't know. I just found that really interesting. And the sirens coming the book after we learn about what happened to Clytemnestra did to Agamemnon And Agamemnon, I think it's important that Agamemnon, of all the Greek heroes to go home and get killed, it's Agamemnon because of he's the high king, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he is the one that goes home and is treacherously killed by his wife. I just find the formal structural place of that in the story to be really fascinating. Heidi, did you have any final thoughts?
Well, yeah, I think to go along with what the two of you are discussing, the epics are, you know, they're not fairy tales. They're not good embodied in a hero and evil embodied in a villain. That even these epic stories, and I've said this before, and this is my favorite thing about the epics, is that they have this grand scale to them. But when it comes to the decisions that each character makes and what motivates the characters, they're profoundly human. Even something like Clytemnestra, who is the closest thing you get to the villain in the story. And Helen might be a better example of this. Helen is completely ambiguous throughout both the Iliad and the Odyssey. We had a 2-hour discussion on this in my class yesterday about Helen, that she is, it's very easy to villainize Helen, to your all's point. It's easy to villainize her, but it's unfair to her because the epic presents her as a human person who's caught in these implacable tensions that are being played out around her by the fates and the gods and the war and love and other people's choices. And that happens over and over again in the Odyssey and in the Iliad, that there's a grand scale, but it all comes down to some of these very human motivations, like Odysseus just wanting to get home.
Yeah,
loving his wife after 20 years. Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're right. And Tim's right about the empathy. And that's something that in later Western stories, like in fairy tales, if you're trying to have empathy for the witch, you're reading the story wrong. She is supposed to be a villain, again, to be true to the world of the story. That in Hansel and Gretel, the witch is just bad, and we're not supposed to have empathy for her, and you're reading the story wrong if you do.
You're not supposed to feel bad for her at the end when she gets cooked in her own oven.
Yes, but that's exactly right. You're supposed to be grateful and don't make some movie about how she has a bad childhood and maybe we should feel a little bit bad for her. That's just reading in fairy tale wrong. But that's not the case with the epics. There is this ambiguity and this humanity that we are, I think, supposed to be drawn into and caught up in and supposed to make us have some question marks above our head as we're reading it.
Hmm. Yeah, have a little empathy for the most beautiful person in the world, all right?
She had a really hard life.
Can you imagine being that?
Heidi's point, I think, is a really good one. It's tempting to give agency to Helen, and you have to kind of remember, wait, she's a war slave. It's hard to be critical of her for not having agency, because she is like this ambiguous character. Yeah, but her will was kind of not her own. She was swept up into this like horrible situation. Anyway, Heidi already said it better than me.
Well, we should wrap up. Tim, do you want to add anything?
One literary nerd thing that I think most people know, the origin of the word barbarian comes from the Greeks. They would call outsiders barbarians. And the reason they did that is because when they heard non-Greek speaking, the language, the words sounded like bar, 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 bar. And so that's where the word barbarian comes from. You guys,
I'm going to go ahead and say that sounds made up, but it's probably true.
It is true. It does sound made up.
I've read it in a couple of different sources.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And I've probably read the same sources. So I'm...
Yeah, Wikipedia for the word.
We read the same books, right?
Hey, Wikipedia, by the way, I think we need to get over. Wikipedia is a great resource.
I know, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Okay. All right, well, thanks to you both. Like I said, we will be covering 4 books for next week. So get your, you know, get your reading in. We will cover 13 through 16. And then the last 4 weeks will all be, you know, two books at a time as we move towards the end of this epic amount of reading. Don't forget about the Daily Poem, which is back now for your school year. Today is actually the 1 year anniversary since we posted the trailer for the Daily Poem, and subsequently me and whoever else has helped from time to time have shared over 210 poems. So, you know, it's been a good year there. So thanks to everyone who's been listening, and you can subscribe to that. And we've got a new batch of episodes of Libromania coming, and of course, The Play's the Thing, and the bonus podcasts on the Patreon feed. And we have a whole bunch of new stuff coming this fall, which I can't make announcements about yet, but which we are working on. And I think are going to be really exciting for everybody. So thanks to everybody who has been leaving reviews and rating the shows and subscribing and telling all your friends. Could not do it without all of your feedback and your support. So thanks to everyone for doing that. And don't forget about the Patreon bonus episode that we are going to record in like 5 minutes. And that's going to be about a Will Cather story called Paul's Case. So if you want to come listen to us talk about a super depressing story, then, you know, join us on Patreon.
It's like, it's lovely also. I had never heard of it. Yeah. And I loved it.
Yeah. It's, I would say bizarre is a good word for it too.
Yeah.
I can't wait to talk to you guys about the story.
All right, well, then let's go do that. Okay, so we'll hang up on this call and we'll start a new one for that. So as always, thanks to everyone for listening. For Heidi White, for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Happy reading. We'll talk to you next week. Mm-hmm.